This is Paul Saunders, and welcome to another edition of In the National Interest. Today, this is another special edition focusing on energy issues, and I'm with Tatiana Mitrova, who's a research fellow at the Columbia University Center on Global Energy Policy and also director of the New Energy Advancement Hub. Tatiana, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
You know, we're obviously now a couple of years after Russia's invasion of Ukraine, 2 weeks maybe, or a week after the second anniversary of the invasion. And I wonder, as you look back on the energy-related consequences of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, what do you see as the biggest consequences for Russia and also for Europe?
Well, let's start with Russia. And surprisingly, frankly, I didn't expect it, but Russia has nearly completely lost the European gas market, which nobody expected before the war started, and which is definitely not in Russia's interests, but the politically driven decisions first to demand payments in rubles, and then actually the whole sabotage of the Nord Stream resulted into the decline of Russian gas exports from 140 BCM down back in 2021 to just 27 BCM in 2023. That's a dramatic loss for Russia in terms of volumes. Russia has lost basically European oil and coal market, but managed to redirect these volumes to the rest of the world. And this is another unexpected consequence that, you know, actually Russian oil exports have increased 7% in 2023 compared to 2021. Despite all the sanctions, all the restrictions, despite the price cap and the whole pressure, but basically it managed to adapt. Nevertheless, I would say there is a huge discussion whether the sanctions are working or not. I would say they are working because Russia is losing its revenues. And though the volumes, except gas, and nearly at the pre-war level, revenues, they are going down and Russian budget starts to feel the pain. It's less than people were expecting in 2022 when the first sanctions were imposed. The idea was to limit revenues in order to stop the aggression. We can see that though the revenues are going down, the aggression doesn't stop. But actions, these sanctions, they are really undermining Russia's ability to generate cash for the development, for the military expenditures, though I'm afraid it will take much longer time than everybody hoped to really undermine this war machine.
So maybe you could talk a little bit about the difference between oil and gas, where the Russian economy is concerned, and also more narrowly the Russian federal budget, because they play very different roles in Russia's economy, right?
That's for sure. So oil has always been a cash machine. It is providing the bulk of the budget revenues, and that's why control over oil export flows was always so important for the domestic elites. Gas, it's providing historically maybe like 20% out of all oil and gas revenues. But it was always extremely important from the geopolitical standpoint. It was the major geopolitical tool of the Kremlin. With the oil, as I've said, Russian companies, they've managed to redirect their export flows very quickly, building up shadow fleet, creating new chains of hidden intermediaries, you know, building up transactions through hidden jurisdictions, transport transmuting this oil, transshipping it in the middle of the night in the open sea. So they've used basically all the tools that you can imagine to bypass this sanction pressure, and they've succeeded. As I said, the volumes are basically the same. The prices are lower than they used to be, but still higher than G7 price cap level, $60 per barrel. It's now nearly impossible, actually, to say what's the real price of Russian oil, because all the transactions moved to shadow. We do not have any transparency and disclosure. We can only guess where these money are going. Part of them end up in the Russian budget. Part disappears somewhere in the offshore jurisdictions. Yeah, maybe most likely used for the further purchase of sanctioned technologies and goods, but who knows? Basically, the functioning of the Russian oil sector is not strongly disturbed. Russia has voluntarily reduced its oil production volumes as a part of OPEC Plus agreement, which is also quite important. It allowed Russia first to get higher prices globally and to compensate partially for the losses related to the sanctions, but also it allowed Russian oil companies to avoid new investments in the most remote and technologically sophisticated fields. Because when you are producing 9.5 million barrels per day, automatically, you are not developing the most expensive oil fields, which should be there at 10.5 million barrels per day. So it provided some flexibility for the oil companies in cherry picking the best assets and maximizing output and revenues there. There are some problems directly related to the war because these very active bombing by the Ukrainian drones of the Russian refineries, which started several months ago, it works. It actually results in a visible drop of the Russian petroleum products output. And Russia has just introduced a ban on petroleum products exports because they are not sufficient for the domestic market. But basically, the whole development, it's rather stable. With gas, it's different. As I've mentioned, gas is not cash generator. It's much more about influence. And losing European market automatically resulted into the loss of this influence. Because it's like a weapon that you can use only once. I suppose after all these destructions, European customers are not willing any longer to check reliability of the Russian gas supplies in the future. So Russia has to look now for the new customers. There are discussions with Turkey regarding Turkish gas hub and potential participation of the Russian gas there. Russia is strongly pushing on increase of gas exports to the Central Asian countries, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, and they've actually reached some success there. And the biggest stake is regarding China. So Russia is strongly pushing forward a Power of Siberia 2 pipeline project with a capacity of 50 billion cubic meters compared to any of Nord Streams. China so far is very cautious, not saying yes, not saying no, just keeping the pores. But for Russian gas industry, it's really a critical matter because it has to reduce output. Gazprom has now about 150 billion cubic meters of spare capacity. It's basically the volumes that before the war Gazprom was exporting to Europe. Now it's all under the ground, idle. Yeah, and obviously there is a need to somehow monetize it. So China is the most important solution. The second solution at which Russian government and Russian companies are looking, this is further development of the LNG exports. After Sakhalin 2 and Yamal LNG, there are several new projects. Arctic LNG 2 first line was already finished. It's starting operation right now. There are two other lines under construction. Russia is discussing Murmansk LNG and Baltic LNG and several other projects. So the government badly needs these projects in order, first of all, to monetize spare gas reserves, but also to build up this geopolitical capacity. And here, the pressure from the international sanctions, I would say, became much stronger. So the US have imposed last year several sanctions on the transshipment facilities, on the liquefaction equipment, on the shipping fleet for LNG, which is really challenging the future of those projects. And I would say that differently from oil, where the key motor was, okay, let Russia keep supplying as much oil as needed to the global market in order to avoid price shocks. With LNG, it's quite different. The US officials made it very clear that they are going to actually terminate this development. And it will be, I assume, quite a fight because Russian gas companies are also quite creative and flexible. They are always finding some bypasses. But here I see a lot of commitment from the US side specifically not to allow this to happen. So we will see how it will develop. But basically, while with oil industry, I think is going to be its performance is going to be rather stable in the years to come because nobody wants shocks. With gas industry, there are much more question marks.
Now, since we're talking here briefly about Russia's aspiration to develop all kinds of new LNG projects, the International Energy Agency expects that new projects in Qatar and the United States will start delivering gas before the Russian projects, and argues that that may pose a little bit of a problem for Russia in finding markets for its gas. What do you think about that, just very briefly?
Yeah, we are looking for forward for a wave of new LNG projects, the next wave of LNG glut starting in 2026, 2027, and it will be a period of fierce competition, obviously. But Russia has now very specific positioning in this market. It is no longer competing for the OECD markets, Europe, Japan. So Russia is doomed actually to supply LNG only to the non-OECD countries, developing countries in Southeast Asia, in Latin America. And there actually, it completely coincides with the aspirations of the Russian leadership to become a sort of leader of the global South against the global West, and to again use gas as a sort of geopolitical tools. So Russian gas companies can actually have very competitive value proposition. The price of gas is really low. They can always devaluate ruble in order to reduce the costs of liquefaction and transportation. And basically, they need just to cover their expenditures because, frankly, Russian economy can no longer be called a market economy. even if it was at a certain period of time, it's much more reminding of Soviet times. So even private companies, actually, they are functioning more as governmental bodies, and profit is no longer such a big deal. Yeah, it's important to have domestic production and all the multiplicatory economic effects from these facilities and production, and it's important to build up geopolitical influence. So just imagine if Novatek, for example, or Gazprom will manage to sign long-term, 20-year-long contracts with Pakistan, Bangladesh for LNG supplies and also for the power generation, LNG to power projects. Yeah, using, for example, Iranian gas turbines. Sounds great. Yeah. And then they will have just price arrangements on the electricity. Yeah, it's all out of sanctions. They can build the whole supply chain. They have committed market, and they definitely get a lot of geopolitical influence in the region. So frankly, I suspect that during this LNG glut, we will see further fragmentation of the global gas market. And Russia, maybe together with China, because frankly, Russian LNG projects cannot fly without Chinese equipment and Chinese LNG tankers. So if they together will initiate such a massive penetration in the Asian markets, they can succeed. Probably the most surprising part here is that it will be beneficial for the climate change battle, because it will allow these countries to have firm supplies of gas for many years ahead, not to be dependent on the vulnerability of the spot markets, and to replace coal. But at the same time, looking at the potential geopolitical consequences, I'm afraid that it will lead to further confrontation of the Cold War type.
Maybe pivoting now just briefly to the internal situation inside Russia. You talked about this glut of natural gas. What implications does that have for Russia's energy economy, for Russia's energy transition, and actually for workers in Russia's energy industry?
Well, these 2 years were very vulnerable, and frankly, there was no time to develop any coherent strategy. Right now, Russian government is reviewing the energy strategy of the Russian Federation, so probably we will learn more in the months to come. But what is leaking so far in the media is, first of all, huge focus on nuclear. Surprise, surprise. So it's not about renewables, actually. The main stake of Russia in terms of new technological development in the energy sector is nuclear, obviously driven by the huge role of Rosatom, dual-purpose role, let's be clear, but also the geopolitical role. Because Rosatom has a lot of activities overseas, again in the developing countries. So it's also important to support it. But there are plans to further increase the share of nuclear domestically, which is a bit strange because it doesn't help to monetize all these stranded oil and gas reserves. Yeah, and there is also coal, don't forget about it. After European ban on coal exports, actually, Russia is also struggling to find the outlet for the coal production. And coal regions are extremely sensitive in terms of social activity and social protests. So it's important not to irritate the coal miners for the government. So they are actually balancing, trying to solve all these contradictory tasks. But you can see clearly there is no space for renewables in this interfuel competition. So priority number one is nuclear. here, priority number two is gas because of Gazprom, because it has always been the state's pocket. Priority number three is coal to avoid social unrest. Renewables, while they are more expensive, you need foreign technologies in order to expand them. Russia has actually created quite a tiny renewable industry before 2020. There were just 5 years of this development, but now it definitely doesn't seem to be a priority on the government's list. And though official statements are like, yes, we will still keep an eye on the renewable projects, and we are still devoted to the development of hydrogen production, for example, though in ridiculous volumes, but okay, we have it. So it's important to have it, just to present it, first of all, to the developing countries like an area of expertise. But actually, I think most of these activities are quite fake, and it is not where the money and the attention are going. So, summing up, I do not see any significant prospects for energy transition development in Russia in the years, if not in the decades to come.
That gives us maybe a good opportunity to pivot for a minute to one of your new projects, the New Energy Advancement Hub. Tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, that's really my beloved child. So the idea was to look at the key barriers on the, for the development of energy transition globally. And yes, okay, in Russia it doesn't work, but for the rest of the world there are many drivers. Then why is it so slow? Why is this road so bumpy? So we started to investigate with our team, and we came up to the conclusion that there is a lot of perception issue. So in many cases, people simply do not know. So the level of awareness is still not sufficient, especially in the developing countries. There are lots of myths about costly and unreliable renewables and so on, though we know that the LCOE of solar is now the lowest, but most of people do not know it. In many cases, it is something very theoretical. You've heard about solar, you've heard about batteries, but you cannot imagine how to make this stuff working in your household. So we are also popularizing these solutions, showing to people, to medium and small enterprises, how exactly it could work and how much does it cost. Because at the end of the day, the real driver for all of us is money. And when you know that basically you can reduce your bill by half simply by installing solar panel on your roof, that's really making a energy transition much more appealing. And also we focus on energy efficiency, which we believe is a very important part of the transition. So the cheapest energy is the one which is not produced and not consumed. And again, you won't believe there are so many simple measures allowing to reduce your energy consumption. We have a course on, which is called Cut Your Bill, and in 2 hours we show how to reduce your energy demand by 30% without any significant capital expenditures. Everyone who has taken this course confirms, yes, we did it. But you know, the psychological paradox is that many people prefer just to talk about energy transition and to call for it instead of doing their homework. So we are working. So it's an educational and popularization project, but it seems that we are working with the human psychology, just trying to change the shift, and to focus people on what really can be done right now without waiting for the brighter future.
Terrific, terrific. Well, it sounds like a very important venture. Absolutely, and congratulations on doing that. Thank you so much, Tatiana, for being with us today, and our very best wishes to you and your work.
Thank you, Paul. Thanks.